Disc 9.
After a time, Martin said, "You look a little old to be freelancing as a taxi."
"I am one miserable pensioner," the driver explained. "The automobile belongs to my first wife's youngest son, who was my stepson before I divorced his mother. He was one of those smart capitalists who bought up industry privatization coupons distributed to the proletarian public, and then turned around and sold them for an overweight profit to the new Russian mafioso, which is how he became owner of a Zeal automobile. He borrows it to me when the ridiculous rent on my privatized apartment needs to get paid at the start of the month."
"What did you do before you retired?" The driver looked quickly at his passenger out of the corner of an eye.
"Believe it or not, no skin off my elbow if you don't. I was a famous, even infamous, chess grandmaster, ranked 23rd in Soviet Union in 1954 when I was a 19-year-old Komsomol champion."
"Why infamous?"
"It was said of me that chess drove me mad as a hatter. The critics who said it did not comprehend that, as a chess-playing psychologist once pointed out, chess cannot drive people mad. Chess is what keeps mad people sane. You don't by any chance play chess?"
"As a matter of fact, I used to. I don't get much of a chance anymore."
"You have heard maybe of the Katovsky gambit?"
"Actually, that rings a bell."
"It's me, the bell that's ringing," the driver said excitedly. "Ippolitya Katovsky in the flesh and blood. My gambit was the talk of tournaments when I played abroad. Belgrade, Paris, London, Milan, once even Miami in the state of Carolina the North. Another time, Peking, when the Chinese People's Republic was still a socialist ally and Mao Zedong a comrade in arms."
Martin noticed the old man's eyes brimming with nostalgia.
"What exactly was the Katovsky gambit?" he inquired.
Katovsky leaned angrily on the horn when a taxi edged in ahead of him.
"Under Soviets, drivers like that would have been sent to harvest cotton in Central Asia. Russia is not the same since our communists lost power. Ha! We gained the freedom to die of hunger. The Katovsky gambit involved offering a poisoned pawn and positioning both bishops on the queen's side to control the diagonals, while knights penetrate on the king's side. Swept opponents away for 2 years until R. Fischer beat me in Reykjavik by ignoring the poisoned pawn and castling on the queen's side after I positioned my bishops."
His lips moving as he played out a gambit in his head, Katovsky fell silent, and Martin didn't interrupt the game. The Zill passed an enormous billboard advertising Marlboro cigarettes and metro stations disgorging swarms of workers. Fatigue overcame Martin. He'd been traveling for 2 days and 2 nights to get from Hrodna to Moscow, and he closed his eyes for a moment that stretched into 20 minutes. When he opened them again, the Zill was on the ring road. Giant cranes filled what Martin could see of the skyline. New buildings with glass facades that reflected the structures across the street were shooting up on both sides of the wide artery. In one of them, he spotted a battered Zill speeding by, but there were so many cars on the road he couldn't be sure it was his. Traffic slowed to a crawl where men in yellow hard hats were digging up a section of the roadway with jackhammers, then sped up again as the Zill spilled through the funnel. Up ahead, an overhead sign indicated the junction for the Petersburg Highway.
"Turn off for Prigorodnaya very shortly now," Katovsky said. "I was one of Boris Spassky's advisors when he lost to Fischer in 1972. If only he would have followed my advice, he could have vacuumed the carpet with Fischer, who made blunder after blunder. Ha! They say the winner in any game of chess is the one who makes the next to last blunder. Here is the Prigorodnaya turnoff. Oh, how time seeps through your fingers when you are not closing your hand into a fist. I remember this road before it was paved. In 1952 and part of 1953, I was driven by a chauffeur to Lavrenty Pavlovich Beria's dacha in Prigorodnaya every Sunday to teach chess to his wife. The lessons came to an end when Comrade Stalin died, and Beria, who behind Stalin's back had created the gulags and purged the most loyal comrades, became executed."
As Katovsky headed down the spur, past a sign that read, "Prigorodnaya, 7 kilometers, the cracked rib in Martin's chest began to ache again. Curiously, the pain seemed familiar. But how in the name of God could pain be familiar? A pulse, the harbinger of a splitting headache, began to beat in Martin's temples, and he brought his fingers up to knead his brow. He found himself slipping into and out of roles. He could hear Lincoln Ditman lazily murmuring a verse of poetry. "The silent cannons, bright as gold, rumble lightly over the stones. Silent cannons, soon to cease your silence, soon unlimbered to begin the red business. And the voice of the poet wearing the soiled white shirt open at the throat. Sight at daybreak, in camp in front of the hospital tent on a stretcher, three dead men lying, each with a blanket spread over him. Other voices, barely audible, played in the lobe of his brain where memory resided. Gradually he began to distinguish fragments of dialogue. Gentlemen and ladies, overlooked Martin Odom's original biography. His mother was Polish, immigrated after the second. Maggie's on to staring us in the face. The driver of the Zill glanced at his passenger. Look at those chimneys spewing filthy white smoke, he said. Uh-huh. That's a paper factory, built after Beria's time, unnecessary to say. He never would have permitted it. Now you are knowing why only little shots live here nowadays. The stench of the sulfur fills the air every hour of every day of every year. The local peasants swear you get used to it, that in time you only feel discomfortable when you breathe air that is not putrid. Even the reek of sulfur stinging Martin's nostrils seemed familiar. Comrade Beria played chess, the driver remembered. Badly. So badly that it required all my cleverness to lose to him. Lincoln Dittman was in triple. Overheard an old lottery vendor talking Polish to a hooker. Catch the drift. His mother used to read him bedtime stories in Polish. Martin found himself breathing with difficulty. He felt as if he were gagging on memories that were stuck in his throat, that needed to be disgorged before he could get on with his life. Ahead, an abandoned customs station with a faded red star painted above the door loomed at the side of the road. Across from it and down a shallow slope, a river rippled through its bed. It must have been in flood because there appeared to be a margin of shallow marshes on either side. Grass could be seen undulating in the current. Martin heard a voice he recognized as his own say aloud, "The river is called the Lesnia, which is the name of the woods it meanders through as it skirts Prigorodnaya." Gotowski slowed the Zill. "I thought you told me you had never been to Prigorodnaya." "Never, no." "Explain, then, how come to know the name of the river?" Martin, concentrating on the voices in his head, didn't reply. "He aced Russian at college, speaking it with a Polish accent. Bringing his Polish up to snuff, they could also work on his Russian." "Pull over," Martin ordered. Gotowski braked the car to a stop, two wheels on the tarmac, two wheels on the soft shoulder. Martin jumped from the car and started walking down the middle of the paved road toward Prigorodnaya. Off to his left, high on the slope near a copse of stunted apple trees, he could see a line of whitewashed beehives. His game leg and broken rib ached. The migraine lurking behind his brow throbbed as he made his way across a landscape that seemed painfully familiar, even though he had never set eyes on it. "Josef has a first name? Half of Poland is named Josef. Precisely the point. I happen to be reading Kafka. Suggest a Polish-sounding variation. Kafkor." Martin detected an unevenness in the tarmac under his feet, and looking down, saw that a section of roadway, roughly the size of a large tractor tire, had been crudely repaved. It had been smoothed over, but the surface was lumpy and the seam was clearly visible. Gazing at the round section of road, he suddenly felt dizzy. He sank onto his knees and looked over his shoulder at the Zill drawing closer to him. His eyes widened in terror as he felt himself being transported back in time through a mustard-thick haze of memory. He saw things he recognized, but his brain, befuddled with chemicals released by fear, could no longer locate the words to describe them. The twin stacks spewing plumes of dirty white smoke, the abandoned customs station with a faded red star painted above the door, the line of whitewashed beehives on a slope near a copse of stunted apple trees. And then, vanquishing terror only to confront a new enemy, madness, he could have sworn he saw an elephant striding over the brow of the hill. The old man driving the Zill was standing alongside the car, one hand on the open door, calling plaintively to his passenger. "I could have crushed Beria every time," he explained, "but I thought I would live longer if I came in second." The voices in Martin's skull grew louder. "Studied Kafka at the Jagiellonian University in Krakow. Worked summers as a guide at Auschwitz. Job in the Polish Tourist Bureau in Moscow. Contact with the DDO target without too much difficulty. Question of knowing where this Samat character hangs out." Martin, his facial muscles contorting, heard himself whisper, "Poshol tinakai." He articulated each of the O's in Poshol. "Go impale yourself on a prick." Pushing himself to his feet, feeling as if he were trapped in a terrible dream, Martin stumbled down the paved spur toward Prigorodnaya. Could he have met Samat before? He had a vision of himself leaning on the bar of a posh watering hole in Bolshaya Komunistichaskaya, called the Commercial Club. In his mind's eye, he could make out the thin figure of a man settling onto the stool next to him. Of medium height, with a pinched, mournful face, he wore suspenders that kept his trousers hiked high on his waist, and a midnight blue Italian suit jacket draped cape-like over a starched white shirt, which was tieless and buttoned up to a very prominent Adam's apple. The initials S and UZ were embroidered on the pocket of the shirt. Martin saw himself placing on the burnished mahogany of the bar a Bolshoi ticket that had been torn in half. From a jacket pocket, the thin man produced another torn ticket. The two halves matched perfectly. Moving his lips like a ventriloquist, Samat could be heard mumbling, "What took you so long? I was told to expect the cutout to make contact with me here last week. It takes time to establish a cover, to rent an apartment, to make it seem as if we are meeting by chance. My uncle Tsvetan wants to see you as soon as possible. He has urgent messages he must send to Langley. He wants assurance he will be exfiltrated if things turn bad. He wants to be sure the people you work for lay in the plumbing for the exfiltration before it is needed. How do I meet him? He lives in a village not far from Moscow. It's called Prigorodnaya. I invite you to his dacha for the weekend. We will tell everyone we were roommates at the Forestry Institute. We studied computer science together in case anyone should ask. I don't know anything about computers. Except for me, neither does anyone else at Prigorodnaya. Martin caught sight of the low wooden houses on the edge of the village ahead, each with its small fenced vegetable garden, several with a cow or a pig tethered to a tree. A burly peasant splitting logs on a stump looked up and appeared to freeze. The large axe slipped from his fingers as he gaped at the visitor. He backed away from Martin, as he would from a ghost, then turned and scampered along the path that ended at the small church with paint peeling from its onion domes. Nearing the church, Martin noticed a patch of terrain behind the cemetery that had been leveled and cemented over. A great circle had been whitewashed onto the surface blackened by engine exhaust. An Orthodox priest wearing a washed-out black robe so short it left his bare matchstick-thin ankles and Nike running shoes exposed stood before the doors of the church. He held a minuscule wooden cross high over his head as men and women, alerted by the log splitter, drifted through the village lanes toward the church. "Is it really you, Yosef?" the priest demanded. As Martin drew nearer, many of the women, whispering to each other, crossed themselves feverishly. Martin approached the priest. "Has Samat come back to Prigorodnaya?" he asked. "Come and departed in his helicopter, donated this cross, fabricated from the wood of the true cross of Zuzovka, to our church here in Prigorodnaya, where his sainted mother prays daily for his soul. For yours, too." "Is he in danger?" "No more, no less than we were after it was discovered that the planks over the crater and the spur had been removed and the man buried alive had gone missing." Martin understood that he was supposed to know what the priest was talking about. "Who protected Samat?" he asked. "His uncle, Tsvetan Ugorzhilov, the one we call the oligarch, protected Samat." "And who protected his uncle?" The priest shook his head. "Organizations too powerful to have their names spoken aloud." "And who protected you when you removed the planks over the crater and freed the man buried alive?" "Almighty God protected us," said the priest, and he crossed himself in the Orthodox style with his free hand. Martin looked up at the onion domes, then back at the priest. "I want to talk to Samat's mother," he announced, thinking she might be among the women watching from the path. "She lives alone in the oligarch's dacha," the priest said. "Christina is a raving lunatic," said the peasant who had been splitting logs. Crossing themselves again, the other peasants nodded in agreement. "And where is the oligarch, then?" Martin thought to ask. "Why, none of us can say where the oligarch went to when he quit Prigorodnaya." "And when did the oligarch leave Prigorodnaya?" "No one knows for sure. One day he was here, struggling down the path near the river on aluminum crutches, his bodyguards following behind, his borzois dancing ahead. The next, the dacha was stripped of its furnishings and echoed with emptiness, and only a single candle burned in a downstairs window during the long winter night." Martin started toward the sprawling dacha, with the wooden crow's nest rising above the white birches that surrounded the house. The peasants blocking the path gave way to let him through. Several reached out to touch an arm, and a toothless old woman cackled, "Back from the dead and buried, then." Gaunt chickens and a rooster with resplendent plumes scrambled out from under Martin's feet, stirring up fine dust from the path. Drawn by curiosity, the villagers and the priest, still holding aloft the sliver of a cross, trailed after him, careful to keep a respectful distance. When Martin reached the wooden fence surrounding the oligarch's dacha, he thought he could make out a woman singing to herself. Unlatching the gate and circling around towards the back of the dacha, he stepped carefully through a neatly tended garden, with alternating furrows of vegetables and sunflowers, until he spotted the source of the singing. An old and frail crone, wearing a threadbare shift and walking barefoot, was filling a plastic can with rainwater from a barrel set under a gutter of the dacha. Long, scraggly white hair plunged across her pale skin, which was stretched tightly over her facial bones, and she had to stab it away from her eyes when she caught sight of Martin to get a better look at him.
"Svetlana's always was correct," she said. "You will have been better able to survive the winter once the hole was covered with snow, though I was dead set against their burying you before you had eaten your lunch."
"You know who I am?" Martin asked.
"You didn't use to ask me silly questions, Yosef. I know you as well as I know my own son, Samat, as well as I knew his father, who hibernated to Siberia during the time of Stalin and never returned. Curious, isn't it, how our lives were utterly and eternally defined by Stalin's whimsical brutality? I knew you would come back, dear Yosef. But what on earth took you so long? I expected you would surely return to Prigorodnaya after the first thaw of the first winter."
The old woman set down her watering can and, taking Martin's hand in hers, led him across the garden to the back door of the dacha.
"You always liked your tea and jam at this hour. You will need a steaming cup to see you through the morning."
Christina pushed through a screen door hanging half off of its hinges and, slipping her soiled feet into a pair of felt slippers, shuffled through a series of deserted rooms to the kitchen, all the while glancing over her shoulder to be sure Martin was still behind her. Using both thin arms, she worked the hand pump until water gushed from the spigot. She filled a blackened kettle and set it to boil on one of the rusting electric plaques sitting on the gas stove that no longer functioned.
"I will fetch your favorite jam from the preserves in the larder of the cellar," she announced. "Dearest Yosef, don't disappear again. Promise me?"
Almost as if she couldn't bear to hear him refuse, she pulled up a trap door and, securing it with a dog's leash, disappeared down a flight of steps. Martin wandered through the ground floor of the dacha, his footfalls echoing from the bare walls of the empty rooms. Through the sulfur-stained panes of the windows, he could make out the priest and his flock of faithful gathered at the fence, talking earnestly among themselves. The double living room with an enormous stone chimney on either end gave onto a study filled with wall-to-wall shelves devoid of books, and beyond that a small room with a low metal field hospital cot set next to a small chimney filled with scraps of paper and dried twigs waiting to be burned. Half a dozen empty perfume bottles were set out on the mantel. A small pile of women's clothing was folded neatly on an upside-down wooden crate with the words Ugor Zhilov and Prigorodnaya stenciled on several of its sides. A dozen or so picture postcards were tacked to the door that led to a toilet. Martin drew closer to the door and examined them. They'd been sent from all over the world. One showed the duty-free shop at Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris, another the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, a third, a bridge spanning the Voltava River in Prague, still another, Buckingham Palace in London. The topmost postcard on the door was a photograph of a family walking down a paved country road past two identical clapboard farmhouses built very close to each other. Across the road, a weathered barn stood on a small rise, an American eagle crafted out of metal sitting atop the ornate weather vane jutting from the mansard roof. The people pictured on the postcard were dressed in clothing farmers might have worn going to church 200 years before. The men and boys were attired in black trousers and black suit jackets and straw hats. The women and girls were wearing ankle-length gingham dresses and laced-up high shoes and bonnets tied under the chin. Martin pried out the tack with his fingernails and turned over the postcard. There was no date on it. The printed caption identifying the picture on the postcard had been scuffed off with a knife blade. The post office cancellation across the stamp read, "Fast, New York." "Mama dearest," someone had written in Russian, "I'm alive and well in America the Beautiful. Do not worry your head for me. Only keep singing when you weed the vegetable garden, which is how I see you in my mind's eye." It was signed, "Your devoted S." The old woman could be heard calling from the kitchen,
"Yosef, my child, where have you gone off to? Come take tea."
Pocketing the postcard, Martin retraced his steps. In the kitchen, the old woman, using a torn apron as a potholder, was filling two cups with an infusion that turned out to have been brewed from carrot peelings, because for her tea had become too expensive. She settled onto a three-legged milking stool, leaving the only chair in the room for her visitor. Martin pulled it up to the table, covered with formica, and sat across from her. The woman kept both of her hands clasped around the cracked mug as she summoned memories and gently rocked her head from side to side at the thought of them. Her lidded eyes flitted from one object to another, like a butterfly looking for a leaf on which to settle.
"I recall the day Samat brought you back from Moscow, Yosef. It was a Tuesday. Ah, you are surprised. The reason I remember it was a Tuesday is because that was the day the woman from the village came to do laundry. She was too terrified to use the electric washing machine Samat brought from Geyuim and scrubbed everything in a shallow reach of the river. You and Samat had been roommates in a school somewhere, so he said when he introduced you to his uncle's entourage. Later, Tsvetan took you aside and asked you question after question about things I did not comprehend. What in the world is an exfiltration? You do remember the oligarch, Yosef. He was a very angry man."
Martin thought he could hear the angry voice of an older man raging against the regime as he lurched back and forth on aluminum crutches before people too cowed to interrupt. "My grandfather was executed during 1929 collectivization. My father was shot to death in a field gone to weed in 1933. Both were found guilty by itinerant tribunals of being kulaks. Do you know who kulaks were, Yosef? For the Soviet scum, they were the so-called rich peasants who wanted to sabotage Stalin's program to collectivize agriculture and drive the peasants onto state farms. Rich, my ass. Kulaks were farmers who owned a single pair of leather shoes, which would last a lifetime because they were only worn inside church. My grandfather, my father, would walk to and from church wearing peasant shoes made of woven reeds, what we called lapti, and put on their leather shoes when they crossed the threshold. Because they owned a pair of leather shoes, my grandfather and my father were branded enemies of the people and shot. Perhaps now you understand why I wage one-man war against Mother Russia. I will never forgive the Soviets or their heirs." Martin looked across the table at the old woman sipping her infusion.
"I remember him saying something about leather shoes," he said.
The woman brightened.
"He told the story to every newcomer to the dacha, how his grandfather and father had been executed by the Soviets because they owned leather shoes. It could have been true, mind you. Then again, it could have been imagined. Those who lived through the Stalinist era can never get out of it. Those who were born afterward can never get in. You are too young to know the Soviet state's greatest secret, why everyone spent their waking hours applauding Stalin. I shall educate you. It is because the walls in the new apartment buildings were insulated with felt, which left the rooms well heated but infested with clothes moths. Our indoor sport was to clap our hands and kill them in mid-flight. We kept score. On any given evening, the one with the most cadavers was declared to be the winner." "Ah," the woman added with a drawn-out sigh, "all that is spilt milk. Samat and Tsvetan, they are both of them gone from here now."
"And where have they gone to?" Martin asked softly. The old woman smiled sadly.
"They have gone to Earth. They have hibernated into holes in the frozen ground."
"And in what country are these holes in the ground?" She gazed out a window.
"I was studying piano at the conservatory when my husband, Samat's father, was falsely accused of being an enemy of the people and sent to Siberia."
She held her fingers up and examined them. Martin could see that the palms of her hands were cracked from dryness and her nails were broken and filthy.
"My husband, for the moment his name slips my mind, it will surely come back to me. My husband was a medical doctor, you see. He never returned from Siberia, though Tsvetan, who made inquiries after the death of Koba, whom you knew as Stalin, heard tales from returning prisoners about his brother running a clinic in a camp for hardened criminals, who paid him with crusts of stale bread."
"Did you and Samat suffer when your husband was arrested?"
"I was expelled from the party. Then they cancelled my stipend and expelled me from the conservatory, though it was not because my husband had been arrested. He and Tsvetan were Armenians, you know, and Armenians wore their arrests the way others wear medals on their chests."
"Why were you expelled then?"
"Dear boy, because they discovered I was an Israelite, of course. My parents had given me a Christian name, Christina, precisely so that the party would not suspect I had Jewish roots. But in the end, the ruse did not work."
"Did you know that Samat went to live in Israel?"
"It was my idea. He needed to emigrate because of the gang wars raging in the streets of Moscow. I was the one who suggested Israel might accept him if he could prove his mother was Jewish.
How did you make ends meet when you lost your conservatory stipend?
While he was in the gulag, Tsvetan arranged for us to be taken care of by his business associates. When he returned, he personally took us both under his wing. He convinced Samat to enroll in the Forestry Institute, though why my son would want to learn forestry was beyond me. And then he sent him to the State Planning Agency's Higher Economics School. What Samat did after that he never told me, though it was clearly important because he came and went in a very shiny limousine driven by a chauffeur. Who would have imagined it? My son driven by a chauffeur.
On a hunch, Martin said, "You don't seem mad." Christina looked surprised.
"And who told you I was?"
"I heard one of the peasants from the village say you were a raving lunatic."
Christina frowned. "I am a raving lunatic when I need to be," she murmured. "It is a formula for protecting yourself from life and from fate. I wrap myself in lunacy the way a peasant pulls a sheepskin coat over his shoulders in winter. When people take you for a raving lunatic, you can say anything, and nobody, not even the party, holds it against you."
"You are not what you seem."
"And you, my dear, dear Yosef, are you what you seem?"
"I'm not sure what you mean by that."
"Samat brought you here. He said you were friends from school. I accepted you in place of the son I had lost at childbirth. The oligarch received you as a member of his entourage and, after several months, as a member of his family. And you betrayed us all. You betrayed Samat, you betrayed me, you betrayed Svetan. Why?"
"I don't remember any of this."
Christina looked at Martin intently. "Does your amnesia protect you from life and from fate, Yosef?"
"If only it could. I run as fast as I can, but life and fate are endlessly and always right behind and gaining on me."
Tears seeped from under Christina's tightly shut lids. "Dear Yosef, that has been my experience also."
Taking leave of Christina, Martin headed back toward Prigorodnaya's church. The crowd of peasants had long since followed the priest back to the church to offer up special prayers for the soul of Yosef Kafkor. Martin was unlatching the garden gate when he heard Samat's mother calling from a window.
"It was Zurab," she shouted.
Martin turned back.
"What about Zurab?" he called.
"Zurab was the given name of Samat's father, my husband, Zurab Ugorzhilov."
Martin smiled and nodded. Christina smiled back and waved goodbye. When he reached the paved spur, Martin found the Zil parked off the roadway in the shade of a grove of birches leaning away from the prevailing winds. Katovsky, his shoes off and trousers rolled up, was downslope from the car, soaking his feet in the cool currents of the Lesnia.
"You wouldn't by any chance be familiar with the fourth game, A. Alekhina versus J. Capablanca, 1927?
The driver called as he scrambled uphill toward Martin.
"I was just now playing it in my head. There was a queen sacrifice more dazzling than the 13-year-old R. Fischer's celebrated queen sacrifice on the 17th move of his Grunfeld defense against the Grandmaster Bern, which stunned the chess world."
"No," Martin said as Katovsky sat on the ground to pull on his shoes. "Never played that game."
"On second thought, you ought to avoid it, comrade visitor. Queen sacrifices are not for the weak of heart. I tried it once in my life. I was 15 at the time, and I was playing the state grandmaster Umansky. When he made his 16th move, I studied the board for 20 minutes and then resigned. There was nothing I could do to avoid defeat. The grandmaster Umansky accepted the victory gracefully. I later discovered he spent months replaying the game. He couldn't figure out what I'd seen to make me surrender. To me, it was as conspicuous as the nose on your face. I would have been a pawn down in 4 moves. My bishop would have been pinned after 7, and the rook file would have been open after 9, with his queen and 2 rooks lined up on it. What I saw was I could not beat the state. If I had to do it over again," the driver added with a sigh, "I would not play the state."
100 meters in from where the Prigorodnaya Spur joined the 4-lane Moscow-Petersburg highway, interior ministry troops in camouflage khakis had blocked off circulation, obliging the occasional automobile to slow to a crawl and slalom between strips of leather fitted with razor-sharp spikes. When Katovsky's Zil came abreast of the parked delivery truck with the DHL logo on its side, baby-faced soldiers armed with submachine guns motioned for the driver to pull off the road. A brawny civilian in a rumpled suit yanked open the passenger door and, grabbing Martin's wrist, dragged him from the car so roughly his cracked rib sent an electric current through his chest. A second civilian wagged a finger at the driver, who was cowering behind the wheel.
"You know the rules, Lifshitz. You could get 6 months for operating a taxi without a license. I might forget to arrest you if you can convince me you didn't take a passenger to Prigorodnaya today."
"How could I take a passenger to Prigorodnaya? I don't even know where it is."
Martin, looking back over his shoulder, asked, "Why are you calling him Lifshitz?" Gripping the nape of Martin's neck in one huge hand and his elbow in the other, the brawny civilian steered the prisoner toward the back of the DHL truck.
"We call him Lifshitz because that's his name."
"He told me it was Kotovsky."
The civilian snorted.
"Kotovsky, the chess grandmaster. He died a decade ago. Lifshitz, the unlicensed taxi driver, was a finalist in the Moscow District Chinese Checkers Tournament 5-6 years ago." "Chess grandmaster. That's a new one in Lifshitz's repertoire."
Moments later, Martin found himself sitting on the dirty floor in the back of the DHL truck, his legs stretched in front of him, his wrists manacled behind his back. The two civilians sat on a makeshift bench across from him, sucking on camels as they gazed impassively at their prisoner through the smoke.
"Where are you taking me?" Martin demanded, but neither of his captors showed the slightest inclination to respond.
At some point, the truck must have turned off the ring road onto a main artery because Martin could sense that it was caught in bumper-to-bumper traffic. Horns shrieked around them. When the truck swerved sharply, Martin could hear the screech of brakes and drivers shouting curses. The two jailers, their eyes fixed on the prisoner, seemed unfazed. After 20 or so minutes, the truck descended a ramp. Martin could tell by the way the motor sounded that they were indoors, and then backed up before coming to a stop. The civilians threw open the rear doors and, gripping Martin under his armpits, hauled him onto a loading ramp and through swinging doors down a long corridor to a waiting freight elevator. The two grilled gates slid closed and the elevator started grinding noisily upward. The doors on the first 5 floors were sealed shut with metal bars welded across them. On the 6th floor, the elevator jerked to a halt. Other civilians waiting outside tugged open the double gates, and Martin, surrounded now by 6 men in civilian suits, was escorted to a holding room painted glossy white and saturated in bright light. The handcuffs were removed from his wrists, after which he was stripped to the skin, and his clothing and his body were meticulously inspected by 2 male nurses wearing white overalls and latex gloves. An overripe doctor in a stained white smock with a cigarette bobbing on her lower lip and a stethoscope dangling from her neck came in to examine Martin's eyes and ears and throat, then listened to his heart and took his blood pressure and probed his cracked rib with the tips of her fingers, causing him to wince. As she went through the motions of checking his health, Martin was more distressed by his nakedness than his plight. He concentrated on her fingernails, which were painted a garish phosphorescent green. He caught the gist of a question she posed in Polish. She wanted to know if he had ever been hospitalized. "Once," he replied in English, "for a shrapnel wound in the lower back and a pinched nerve in my left leg, which still aches when I spend too much time on my feet." The doctor must have understood his response because she ran her fingers down the length of the back wound, then asked if he took any medication. "From time to time, an aspirin," he said. "What do you do between aspirins?" she asked. "I live with the pain," he said. Nodding, the doctor noted his response and checked off items on a clipboard and signed and dated the form before handing it to one of the civilians. As she turned to leave, Martin asked if she was a generalist or a specialist. The woman smiled slightly. "When I am not freelancing for the service, I am a gynecologist," she said. Martin was ordered to dress. One of the civilians led the prisoner to a door at the far end of the room and, opening it, stood aside. Martin shuffled into a larger room. Once again, the laces had been removed from his shoes, making it difficult to walk normally. Filled with sturdy furniture, hand-me-downs, so he surmised, from the days when Stalin's KGB ruled the roost in what was then called the Soviet Union. A short, husky, middle-aged man wearing tinted eyeglasses presided from behind a monster of a desk. The man nodded toward the wooden chair facing the desk. Martin gingerly lowered himself onto the seat. "Thirsty," he said in Russian. The interrogator snapped his fingers. A moment later, a glass of water was set on the desk within reach of the prisoner. Holding it in both hands, he drank it off in several long gulps. "I am a Canadian citizen," Martin announced in English. "I insist on seeing someone from the Canadian embassy." Behind the desk, the civilian angled a very bright light into Martin's eyes, forcing him to squint. A husky voice that was perfectly harmonious with the huskiness of the civilian drifted out of the blinding light.
"You are voyaging under a passport that identifies you as Kafkor, Yosef," the interrogator said in excellent English.
The passport purports to be Canadian, though it is, as you are no doubt aware, a forgery. The name on it is Polish. The Russian Federal Security Service has been eager to get its hands on you since your name first came to our attention. You are the Kavkor Yosef who was associated with Samat Ugorzhilov and his uncle, Tsvetan Ugorzhilov, better known as the oligarch.
Is that a question? Martin asked.
It is a statement of fact, the interrogator replied evenly.
According to our register, you met Samat Ugorzhilov shortly after arriving in Moscow to work for the Polish Tourist Bureau. You were taken by the same Samat Ugorzhilov to meet his uncle, who was living in the former Beria Dacha in Prigorodnaya. In the 4 months that followed your initial visit to Prigorodnaya, you spent a great deal of time as a guest at the Dacha, sometimes remaining there the entire week, other times going out for four-day weekends. The ostensible reason for the visits was that you were going to teach conversational Polish to Samat's mother, who lived in the Dacha. Your superiors at the Polish Tourist Bureau did not complain about your prolonged absences, which led us to conclude that the Tourist Bureau was a cover. You were obviously a Polish national, though we suspected you had spent part of your life abroad because our Polish speakers who listened to tapes of you talking with your co-workers in Moscow identified occasional lapses in grammar and antiquated vocabulary. You spoke Russian, I assume you still do, with a pronounced Polish accent, which suggested you had studied the Russian language from Polish teachers in Poland or abroad. So, Gospodin Kavkor, were you working for Polish intelligence, or were you employed, with or without the collaboration of the Poles, by a Western intelligence service? Martin said, You are mistaking me for someone else. I swear to you I don't remember any of these details you describe. The interrogator opened a dossier with a diagonal red stripe across the cover and began leafing through a thick stack of papers. After a moment he raised his eyes. At some point your relationship with Samat and his uncle deteriorated. You disappeared from view for a period of 6 weeks. When you reappeared, you were unrecognizable. You had obviously been tortured and starved. Early one morning, while road workers were paving the 7-kilometer spur that led from the main Moscow-Petersburg highway to the village of Prigorodnaya, two of the oligarch's bodyguards escorted you across the Lesnia in a rowboat and prodded you up the incline to a crater that had been gouged into the spur by a steam shovel the previous day. You were stark naked, a large safety pin attached to a fragment of cardboard bearing the words The Spy Kavkor had been passed through the flesh between your shoulder blades. And then, before the eyes of 40 or so workers, you were buried alive in the crater. You were forced to lie in a fetal position in the hole, which was roughly the size of a large tractor tire. Thick planks were wedged into place above you, after which the road workers were obliged to pave over the spot. Martin had the unnerving sensation that a motion picture he had seen and forgotten was being described to him. More water, he murmured. Another glass of water was placed within reach, and he drank it off. In a hoarse whisper, Martin asked, How can you know these things? The interrogator twisted the arm of the lamp so that the light played on the top of the desk. As the interrogator sent out 5 blown-up photographs, Martin caught a glimpse of Kavkor's Canadian passport, a wad of American dollars and British pounds, the picture postcard that he'd swiped from the door of the dacha in Prigorodnaya, along with his shoelaces. He scraped his chair closer to the desk and leaned over the photographs. They were all taken from a distance and enlarged, rendering them grainy and slightly out of focus. In the first photograph, an emaciated man, completely naked, with a matted beard and what looked like a crown of thorns on his head, could be seen stepping gingerly through the shallow slime onto dry land. 2 guards in striped shirts followed behind him. In the next photograph, the naked man could be seen kneeling at the edge of a crater, looking over his shoulder, his eyes hollow with terror. The 3rd photograph in the series showed a thin figure of a man with a long, pinched face, a suit jacket draped cape-like over his shoulders, offering a cigarette to the condemned man. The 4th photograph caught a heavy-set man with a shock of silver hair and dark glasses in the back of a limousine, staring over the tinted window open the width of a fist. In the last photograph, a steamroller was backing across the glistening tarmac, raising a soft fume. Workers leaning on rakes or shovels could be seen staring in horror at the scene of the execution. One of the workmen on the road crew, the ironmonger in point of fact, was employed by our security services, the interrogator said. He had a camera hidden in the thermos in his lunchbox. Do you recognize yourself in these photographs, Gospodin Kavkor? A single word worked its way up from Martin's parched throat. Niet. The interrogator switched off the light. Martin felt the world spinning giddily under his feet.
His lids drifted closed over his eyes as his forehead sank onto one of the photos. The interrogator didn't break the silence until the prisoner sat up again. Martin heard himself ask, "When did all this happen?"
"A long time ago."
Martin sagged back into his seat. "For me," he remarked tiredly, "yesterday is a long time ago. The day before yesterday is a previous incarnation." "The photographs were taken in 1994, the interrogator said. Martin breathed the words, "3 years ago." Kneading his forehead, he tried to work the pieces of this strange puzzle into place. No matter which way he turned and twisted them, no coherent picture emerged. "What happened after this individual was buried alive?" he asked. "When the photographs were developed and circulated, we decided to mount an operation to free him, to free you, in the hope that you were still alive. When we reached the site of the execution in the dead of night, we discovered the peasants, led by the village priest, had already scraped away the tarmac and pried up the planks and rescued the man buried in the crater. Before first light, our people helped the peasants replace the planks and tar over the spot." "And what happened to this person?"
"The village's tractor repairman drove you to Moscow in Prigorodnaya's tow truck. His intention was to take you to a hospital. At a red light on the ring road not far from the American embassy, you leaped from the cab of the truck and disappeared in the darkness. Neither the municipal police nor our service was able to find any trace of you after that. As far as we were concerned, you disappeared from the surface of the earth. Until today, until a customs officer at the airport signaled the arrival of a Canadian bearing a passport issued to Kafkor Yosef. We assumed you would be returning to Prigorodnaya, which is the reason the Interior Ministry troops closed the road. We knew we could pick you up on the way out."
A secretary appeared behind the desk and, bending close, whispered in the interrogator's ear. Clearly annoyed, the interrogator demanded, "How long ago?" Then, "How in the world did he find out?" Shaking his head in disgust, the interrogator turned back to Martin. "The CIA station chief in Moscow has learned that you are in our hands. He is sending a formal request through channels asking us to turn you over to his agency for interrogation when we've finished with you."
"Why would the CIA want to question Yosef Kafkor?"
"They will want to discover if you were able to tell us what we want to know."
"And what is it that you want to know?"
"Whose side were they on?"
"Samat Ugorzhilov and the oligarch, Tsvetan Ugorzhilov."
"And where are they now?"
"Samat took refuge in a West Bank Jewish settlement in Israel."
The interrogator carefully unhooked his eyeglasses from one ear and then the other, and began to clean the lenses with the tip of his silk tie.
"Bring tea," he instructed the secretary. "Also those brioche cakes stuffed with fig confiture."
He fitted the glasses back on, and collecting the 5 photographs, slipped them back into the folder.
"Gospodin Kafkor, the Russian Federal Security Service is underfunded and understaffed and underappreciated, but we are not dimwits. That Samat took refuge in Israel we have known for a long time. We were negotiating with the Israeli Mossad to have access to him when word reached him that Chechen hitmen had tracked him to Israel, causing him to flee the country. But where did he go when he disappeared from Israel?"
The interrogator leafed through more reports.
"He was sighted in the Golders Green section of London. He was seen again in the vicinity of the Vysera train station in Prague. He was said to have visited the town of Kantubek on the island of Vozrozhdinye in the Aral Sea. There were reports, too, that he may have gone to the Lithuanian town of Zuzovka, not far from the frontier with Belarus. There is even a rumor that he was the mysterious person who turned up in the helicopter that touched down for 30 minutes behind the cemetery in Prigorodnaya."
The secretary turned up at the door carrying a tray. The interrogator motioned for him to set it on the small round table between 2 high-backed chairs and leave. When he was alone with the prisoner, he waved him over to one of the chairs. Settling into the other chair, he filled 2 mugs with steaming tea.
"You must try one of the cakes," he advised, sliding the straw basket toward Martin. "They are so delicious it must surely count as a sin to eat them." "So, Gospodin Kafkor, let us sin together," he added, biting into one of the cakes, cupping a hand under it to catch the crumbs. "My name is Cheklashvili," the interrogator said, speaking as he took another bite out of his cake.
"Archip Cheklashvili."
"That's a Georgian name," Martin noted.
"My roots are Georgian, though I have long since offered my allegiance to Mother Russia. It was me," he added, with a distinct twinkle in his eyes, "the ironmonger on the slope who was employed by our security services.
It was me who took the photographs of you with a camera hidden in my lunchbox.
You've come up in the world, Martin commented.
Photographing your execution was my first great triumph. It caught the attention of my superiors and started me up the career ladder. After you jumped from the tow truck and disappeared in Moscow, we heard rumors that you had found your way to the American embassy on the Ring Road. The CIA station chief himself was said to have taken you in charge. There was a flurry of coded radio traffic for 48 hours, after which you were spirited out of Moscow in an embassy car heading for Finland. There were 5 men in the car. All of them had diplomatic passports and were able to pass the frontier without scrutiny. What happened to you after that, we simply do not know. To tell you the truth, I suspect you don't know either.
Martin stared at his interrogator. What makes you suppose that?
The interrogator collected his thoughts.
My father was arrested by the KGB in 1953. He was accused of being an American agent and sentenced by a summary tribunal to be shot. The guards took him from his cell in the vast Lubyanka headquarters of the KGB one night in March and brought him to the elevator that carried prisoners down to the vaulted basements for execution. When they discovered that the elevator was not working, they returned him to his cell. Technicians worked through the night to repair the elevator. In the morning, the guards came for my father again. They were waiting for the elevator to climb to their floor when word reached them that Stalin was dead. All executions were canceled. Several days later, the new leadership killed Beria and issued a general amnesty, and my father was set free.
What does his story have to do with me?
I remember my father returning to our communal apartment. I was 6 years old at the time. It had been raining, and he was drenched to the skin. My mother asked him where he had been. He shook his head in confusion. There was a vacant look in his eyes, as if he had glimpsed some horrible thing, some monster or ghost. He didn't remember his arrest, he didn't remember the summary tribunal, he didn't remember the guards leading him to the elevator for execution. It was all erased from his consciousness. When I went to work for the security apparatus, I looked up his dossier and found out what had happened to him. By then, my father had been put out to pasture. One day, years later, I worked up the nerve to tell him what I had discovered. He listened the way one does to the story of someone else's life, and smiled politely as if the life I had dredged up had nothing to do with him, and went on with the life he remembered, which was the life he lived until the day he died. Drinking off the last of his tea, the interrogator produced a small key from the pocket of his vest and offered it to Martin.
If you go through that door, you will find a narrow staircase, spiraling down 6 floors to the street level. The key opens the door at the bottom of the staircase leading to a side street. When you are outside, lock the door behind you and throw the key down a sewer.
Why are you doing this?
I believe you when you say you don't remember being brought across the river and buried alive. I believe you when you say you don't know Samat Ugurzhilov or his uncle, the oligarch. I have concluded that you are unable to help us with our inquiries. If you are intelligent, you will quit Russia as rapidly as you can. Whatever you do, don't go to the American embassy. The CIA station chief has been making discreet inquiries for the past several weeks about someone named Martin Odom. From his description, we suspect that Martin Odom and Yosef Kafkor are the same person.
Martin started to mutter his thanks, but the interrogator cut him off.
The skeletal man in the third photograph, the one offering the condemned man a last cigarette, is Samat Ugurzhilov. The man with silver hair watching the execution from the partly open window of the automobile is the oligarch, Tsvetan Ugurzhilov. Keep in mind that they attempted to execute you once. They will surely try again if they discover your whereabouts. Ah, I must not forget to return to you your belongings. He retrieved the Canadian passport, the wad of bills, the picture postcard showing a family strolling down a country road somewhere in North America, and the shoelaces, and handed everything to the prisoner. The interrogator watched as the prisoner threaded the laces through his shoes. When Martin looked up, the interrogator shrugged his heavy shoulders, a gesture that conveyed his presumption there was nothing more to say. Martin nodded in agreement. How can I repay you? He asked.
You cannot.
The lines around the interrogator's eyes stretched into a controlled smile.
By the way, Archip Cheklashvili is a legend. I assume that Yosef Kafkor and Martin Odom are also legends. The Cold War is over, still we live our legends. You may well be its last victim, lost in a labyrinth of legends. Perhaps with the aid of the postcard, you will be able to find a way out.
1992. How Lincoln Ditman Came to Go to Language School. "Gentlemen and ladies," declared the former station chief who chaired the legend committee, rapping his knuckles on the oval table to encourage his charges to simmer down, "I invite your attention to a remarkable detail that we seem to have overlooked in Martin Odom's biography." "Are you thinking what I'm thinking?" asked the Yale-educated aversion therapist. "His mother was..." "She was Polish, for heaven's sake," snapped Maggie Poole, speaking, as always, with more than a trace of the British accent that had rubbed off on her at Oxford. She added brightly, "His mother immigrated to Les États-Unis after the Second World War." "We are on to something," said the only other woman at the committee, a lexicographer on permanent loan from the University of Chicago. "I can't believe we missed this." "The detail has been staring us in the face every time we worked up a cover story for him," agreed the committee's doyen, a grisly CIA fossil who had begun his long and illustrious career devising false identities for OSS agents during World War II. He looked at the chairman and asked, "What started you thinking along these lines?" "When Lincoln Ditman returned home from Triple Border," the chairman said, "the subsequent action report mentioned that he'd overheard an old lottery vendor talking Polish to a hooker in a bar and discovered he could catch the drift of what they were saying." "That's because his mother used to read him bedtime stories in Polish when they were living in that Pennsylvania backwater called Jonestown," the aversion therapist explained impatiently. "Mon Dieu, 6 months of intensive tutoring and he'll talk Polish like a native," said Maggie Poole. "Which is not how you talk American English," quipped the aversion therapist. "You can't resist, can you, Troy?" "Oh dear, resist what?" he asked, looking around innocently. The chairman rapped his knuckles on the table again. "Given what the deputy director operations has in mind for Lincoln," he said, "he really ought to speak Russian, too." "Martin Odom studied Russian at college," the lexicographer noted. "Not surprisingly, he wound up speaking it with a Polish accent." "While the tutors are bringing his Polish up to snuff," Maggie Poole suggested, "they could also work on his Russian." "Okay, let's summarize," said the chairman. "What we have is a Polish national who, like most Poles, speaks fluent Russian. What we need now is a name." "Let's be simple for once." "Easier said than done. Le simple n'est pas le facile." "What about using Franz Josef as a first name?" "Are we being inspired by the Emperor of Austria or Haydn?" "Either or." "What about just plain Josef?" offered Maggie Poole. "Half of Poland is named Josef." "That's precisely the point, it seems to me," she retorted. "That's not what you argued when we settled on the name Dante Pippin. You said nobody thumbing down a list of names would suspect Dante Pippin of being a pseudonym precisely because it was so unusual." Maggie Poole would not be put off. "Consistency," she said huffily, "is the last refuge of the unimaginative. That's Oscar Wilde, in case you're wondering." "I happen to be rereading Kafka's America." "For God's sake, you're not going to suggest Kafka as a family name." "I was going to suggest a Polish-sounding variation, Kafkor." "Kafkor, Josef, not half bad. It's short and sweet, an easy handle to slip into, I should think. What do you think, Lincoln?" Lincoln Ditman, gazing out the window of the fourth-floor conference room at the hundreds of cars in the Langley parking lot, turned back toward the members of the Legend Committee. "A variation on the name of Kafka, Kafkor, seems appropriate enough." "What on earth do you mean by appropriate?" "Kafka wrote stories about anguished individuals struggling to survive a nightmarish world, which was more or less how the principal of this new legend would see himself." "You've obviously read Kafka," Maggie Poole said. "He could have read into Kafka at the Jagiellonian University in Krakow," someone noted. "He could have worked summers as a guide at Auschwitz." "Through our contacts in Warsaw, we could land him a job in the Polish Tourist Bureau in Moscow. From there, he ought to be able to make contact with the DDO target without attracting too much attention to himself." "Question of knowing where this Samat character hangs out when he's in Moscow." "That's Crystal Quest's bailiwick," Lincoln remarked. 1997. Martin Odom gets to inspect the Siberian night moth. The phone on the other end of the line had rung so many times, Martin had given up counting. He decided to let it ring all evening, all night, all the next day, if necessary. She had to return home sometime. A woman carrying a sleeping baby on her hip rapped a coin against the glass door of the booth and angrily held up her wrist so that Martin could see the watch on it. Muttering, "Find another booth, I bought this one," he turned his back on her. Shaking her head at how insufferable certain inhabitants of the borough had become, the woman stalked off. In Martin's ear, the phone continued to ring with such regularity that he ceased to be conscious of the sound. His thoughts wandered. He played back what he could remember of the previous phone calls. To his surprise, he was able to recreate her voice in his brain as if he were a skilled ventriloquist. He could hear her saying, "When the answers are elusive, you have to learn to live with the questions." It dawned on him that the phone was no longer ringing on the other end of the line. Another human being was breathing hard into the mouthpiece. "Stella?"
"Martin, is that you?" a voice remarkably like Stella's demanded.
Martin was surprised when he realized how eager he was to hear that voice, to talk to the one person on Earth who was not put off because he wasn't sure who he was, who seemed ready to live with whatever version of himself he offered up. Suddenly he felt the dead bird stirring in him. He ached to see the night moth tattooed under her breast.
"It's me, Stella. It's Martin."
"Jesus, Martin. Wow, I can't believe it.
I've been ringing for hours. Where were you?"
"I met some Russians in Throckmorton's mini-market on Kingston Avenue. They were new immigrants, practically off the boat. I was entertaining them with jokes I used to tell in Moscow when I worked for Subsection Marks. You want to hear a great one I just remembered?"
"Uh-huh." Anything to keep her talking. She giggled at the punchline before she told the joke.
"Okay," she said, collecting herself. "Three men find themselves in a cell in the Lubyanka prison. After a while, the first prisoner asks the second, 'What are you here for?' And the second prisoner says, 'I was against Popov. What about you?' And the first prisoner says, 'I was for Popov.' The two turn to the third prisoner and ask, 'Why were you arrested?' And he answers, 'I'm Popov.'"
She became exasperated when Martin didn't laugh.
"When I delivered the punchline at the Moscow Writers' Union, people would roll on the floor. Someone in Subsection Marks tracked the joke. It spread across Moscow in 3 days and reached Vladivostok in a week and a half. The Russians in Throckmorton's mini-market actually applauded. And you don't get it?"
"I get it, Stella. It's not funny. It's pathetic. When your joke spread across Russia, people weren't laughing. They were crying."
Stella thought about that.
"There may be something to what you say. Hey, where are you calling from this time? Murmansk on the Barents Sea? Irkutsk on Lake Baikal?"
"Listen up, Stella. Do you remember the first time I ever phoned you?"
"How could I forget? You called to tell me you didn't have a change of mind, you had a change of heart. You were phoning from..."
He cut her off. "I was calling from a booth that reeked of turpentine."
He could hear her catch her breath.
"On the corner of..."
He interrupted her again. "Could you find the booth if your life depended on it?" She said very calmly,
"My life does depend on it."
"Do me a favor and bring the autopsy report on your father that the FBI guy sent you."
"Anything else?"
"Uh-huh. That time when I met your father, he removed a pearl-handled souvenir from the pocket of his robe and put it on a shelf where I could see it. I'd like to get my hand on that object, if it's possible."
"Anything else?"
"As a matter of fact, yes. I'd like to inspect the night moth."
"No problem," she said. "It goes where I go."
They were nursing mugs of lukewarm coffee in a booth at the back of the 24-hour diner on Kingston Avenue, two stores down from Throckmorton's mini-market. Stella kept looking up at Martin, phrases formed in her mind only to become stuck on the tip of her tongue. When she had turned up at the phone booth on the corner of Lincoln and Schenectady, they had hugged awkwardly for a moment. The faint aroma of rose petals seeped from under the collar on the back of her neck. Stella had said something about how they really ought to kiss, and they did, but the kiss was self-conscious and quick and a disappointment to both of them. At a loss for words, he'd remarked that he'd never seen her in anything but pants. She said she'd worn the tight knee-length black skirt to disguise herself as a woman. He'd actually managed to smile and said that the deception could have fooled him. He asked her if she had taken precautions to make sure she wasn't being followed. She explained how she had strolled over to an ice cream parlor on Rogers Avenue crammed with teenagers playing electronic pinball machines, then ducked out a back doorway into an alley and made her way through empty side streets to Schenectady and the phone booth. Nodding, he had taken her by the arm and steered her wordlessly in the direction of the all-night diner on Kingston. Sitting across from her now, he noticed the new front tooth. It was whiter than the rest of her teeth and hard to miss. Her hair was pulled back and twined into a braid that plunged out of sight behind her shoulder blades. He recognized the small wrinkles fanning out from the corners of her eyes, which were fixed in a faint squint, as if she were trying to peer into him. The three top buttons of her man's shirt were open, the triangle of pale skin shimmering on her chest. Martin cleared his throat. "You threatened to show me the tattoo the next time we met."
"Here? Now?"
"Why not?" Stella looked around. There were four Chinese women in a booth across the diner playing mahjong, and a young man and a girl two booths away staring so intently into each other's eyes, Stella doubted they would be distracted by anything less than an earthquake. She took a deep breath to work up her nerve and undid three more buttons on her shirt and pulled the fabric away from her right breast. Visions invaded Martin's brain. A neon light sizzling over a bar on the Beirut waterfront. A room upstairs with the torn painting depicting Napoleon's defeat at Accra. The night moth tattooed under the right breast of the Alawite prostitute who went by the name of Jamila. "You want the God-honest truth?" he whispered. "Your Siberian night moth takes my breath away." The ghost of a smile materialized on Stella's lips. "That's what it's supposed to do. The Jamaican tattoo artist on Empire Boulevard said I could have my money back if it didn't bowl you over. Maybe now one thing will lead to another." He reached for her hand, and she folded her other hand on top of his, and they both leaned across the table and kissed. Settling back, Martin said, "Business first." "I like your formula," Stella said, rebuttoning her shirt. He looked surprised. "Why?" "Reading between the lines, it puts pleasure on the agenda." A smile touched his eyes. "Did you bring the autopsy report?" She pulled the report and the letter that had come with it from her leather satchel and unfolded them on the table. Martin skimmed the autopsy report first. Myocardial infarction, clot superimposed on plaque in coronary artery already constricted by cholesterol buildup, abrupt and severe drop in blood flow, irreparable trauma to a portion of the heart muscle. Death would have been almost instantaneous.
"Uh-huh." "Uh-huh what?"
"The CIA doctor seems to be saying your father died a natural death."
"As opposed to an unnatural death? As opposed to murder?"
Martin started reading the covering letter the FBI had sent with the autopsy report. No trace of forced entry. Even if there had been, Mr. Kastner had a charged Tula Tukhariev within arm's reach. No evidence of a struggle. Unfortunately, not unusual for people confined like Mr. Kastner was to a wheelchair to experience blood clots originating in a leg that work their way up to the coronary arteries. Minuscule break in the skin near a shoulder blade compatible with an insect bite. Feel free to call me on my unlisted number if you have any questions. Martin looked up. "Did your father go out often?"
"Kastner never left the house. He didn't even go into the garden behind the house. He spent his time cleaning and oiling his collection of guns."
"If he didn't go out, how did he get bitten by an insect?"
"You aren't convinced by the autopsy report?"
Martin glanced at the signature at the bottom of the letter, then stiffened. Stella asked, "What's not right?"
"I used to know a Felix Kick who worked for the FBI. There was another agent in charge of the witness protection program when Kastner and I and Yelena came over in 1988. We met him several times when we were living at the CIA safe house in Tyson's Corner outside of Washington. The agent retired in 1995. He came to President Street to introduce the person who was taking his place. That's how we met Mr. Kick."
"Short, stumpy, with a low center of gravity that makes him look like an NFL linesman? Nice open face?"
"That's the one. Do you know him?"
"Our paths crossed several times when I worked for the CIA. I knew him as a counterterrorism specialist, but they probably booted him upstairs at the end of his career. The witness protection people are usually running in place, waiting for retirement to catch up with them." Martin thought of something. "When I met your father, he mentioned he'd gotten my name from someone in Washington. Was that someone Felix Kick?" Stella could see that the question was bothering Martin. She considered carefully before answering.
"Kastner called the unlisted number in Washington we'd been given in case we needed anything. Now that you mention it, it was Mr. Kick who said there was a good detective living not far from us. He recommended you, but he told Kastner not to tell you where he'd gotten your name."
Martin seemed to be focusing on horizons that Stella couldn't see. "So it was no accident that I wound up walking back the cat on Samat Ugorzhilov." Stella said,
"I brought the souvenir with the pearl handle."
She opened the satchel and tilted it so Martin could see her father's Tula Tokarev.
"It's an antique, but it still shoots. It was Kastner's favorite handgun. From time to time, he went down to the basement and fired it into a carton filled with roof insulation. Then he'd recovered the bullet and examine it under a low-powered microscope. I brought bullets for it, too."
Stella touched her lips to the coffee, but found it had grown cold. Martin signaled for refills. The waiter, a teenage boy with long sideburns and a silver stud in the side of a nostril, brought two steaming mugs of coffee and took away the old ones. She said, "What about Samat?" "I think I know how to locate him."
"Quit."
"I'm sorry?"
"Quit. Forget Samat. Concentrate on locating me."
"What about your father?"
"What's Kastner have to do with your deciding to quit?"
"He hired me. He's dead, which means he can't unhire me." Martin reached again for her wrist, but she snatched it back.
"I haven't come all this way to quit now," he insisted. "You're crazy."
She noticed the expression on his face.
"I didn't mean that the way it sounded. You're not crazy, crazy. You are imperfectly sane. Admit it, your behavior is sometimes borderline. In your shoes, anyone else would shrug and get on with his life."
"You mean his lives?" Martin reached again for her wrist. This time she didn't pull away. He fingered her watch and began absently winding the stem. "Samat's in America," he said.
"How do you know that?"
He produced the picture postcard and told her how he had tracked Samat from Israel to London to Prague to Vorozhdinye Island in the Aral Sea to the Lithuanian village of Zuzovka, and finally to the village of Prigorodnaya, not far from Moscow, where Samat's mother, Kristina, lived in the empty Dacha once owned by the most hated man in Russia, Lavrenty Beria. "She told me she was a raving lunatic when she needed to be," Martin said. "She told me she wrapped herself in lunacy the way a peasant pulls a sheepskin coat over his shoulders in winter."
"Sounds to me like a survival strategy."
Stella examined the photograph on the postcard, the men and boys attired in black trousers and black suit jackets and straw hats, the women and girls wearing ankle-length gingham dresses and laced-up high shoes and bonnets tied under the chin. She turned it over and translated the message.
"Mama dearest, I am alive and well in America the Beautiful. Your devoted S."
She noticed the printed caption had been scraped off.
"Where in God's green earth is Fast New York?"
she demanded, squinting at the post office cancellation mark across the stamp. "I've done my homework. The people in the photograph are Amish. Belfast, New York, is the rough center of the Amish community that lives upstate New York, and the only town upstate that ends in Fast. It makes tradecraft sense. All the men have long beards. Instead of shaving off his beard, which is what the Russian revolutionaries used to do when they wanted to disappear, Samat would keep his and dress like the Amish and melt into the madding crowd."
"Who's he hiding from?"
"For starters, Chechen gangsters bent on revenge for the killing of one of their leaders known as the Ottoman. Then there's your sister, also his uncle Akim, who claims Samat siphoned off $130 million from holding companies he controlled. For some reason I can't figure out, the CIA seems to be very interested in him, too."
"Where do I come in?"
"When you described Samat to me in the pool parlor."
"That seems so long ago, it must have been during a previous incarnation."
"You're talking to a world-class expert on previous incarnations. When you described him, you said his eyes were seaweed green and utterly devoid of emotion. You told me if you could see his eyes, you would be able to pick him out of a crowd."
Martin lowered his voice.
"I don't mean to push you past where you're ready to go. How come you know his eyes so well?"
Stella turned away. After a moment, she said, "You wouldn't ask the question if you didn't imagine the answer."
"You saw his seaweed green eyes up close when you slept with him."
Stella groaned. "The night of the wedding, he came to my room in the early hours of the morning. He slipped under the covers. He was naked. He warned me not to make a commotion. He said it would only hurt my sister when he told her I'd invited him."
Stella looked into Martin's eyes.
"I'd know his eyes anywhere because I memorized them when he fucked me in the room next to my sister's bedroom on the night of her marriage to this monster of a man. I was originally planning to stay in Kiryat Arba for 3 weeks, but I left after 10 days. He came into my bed every night I was there."
"And when you returned 2 years later?"
"I took him aside the first day and told him I'd kill him if he came into my bed again."
"How did he react?"
"He only laughed. At night he would turn the doorknob to torture me, but he didn't come into the room. Martin, you've got to tell me the truth. Does this change anything between us?"
He shook his head, no. Stella permitted the ghost of a smile to settle softly onto her lips again. 1997. Martin Odom gets the get. Driving in the vintage Packard he had borrowed from his friend and landlord, Tso Singh, the owner of the Mandarin restaurant below the pool parlor on Albany Avenue, Martin and Stella reached Belfast after dark.
The pimply boy working the pump at the gas station on the edge of town ticked off on grimy fingers the choices available to them. A bunch of decent hotels in town, some pricier than others, an assortment of motels along Route 19 either side of town, some seedier than others, several bed and breakfasts, best one by a country mile was old Mrs. Sales' place on a groundswell overseeing the Genesee, the advantage being the riot of river water which lulled some folks to sleep, the disadvantage being the riot of river water which kept some folks up until all hours. They found their way to the house on the river with B&B and Lelia Sales etched on a shingle hanging from a branch of an ancient oak, and reached through the tear in the screen to work the knocker on the front door. As they didn't have luggage, Martin was obliged to cough up $30 in advance for a room with a matrimonial bed, bathroom down the hall, kindly go barefoot if you use the facilities during the night so as not to wake the ghosts sleeping in the attic. They went out to get a bite to eat at a diner across from the public library on South Main and lingered over the decaf, both of them trying to put off the moment when there would be no turning back. Parking on the gravel in Mrs. Sales's driveway afterward, Martin decided the Packard's engine oil level needed checking. "I'm every bit as agitated as you," Stella murmured, reading his mind as he propped up the hood. She started toward the house, then wheeled back when she reached the porch, her left palm drifting up to the triangle of pale skin visible on her chest. "Look at it this way, Martin," she called. "If the sex doesn't work out to everyone's expectations, we can always fall back on the erotic phone relationship." "I want sex and the erotic phone relationship," he replied. Stella angled her head to one side. "Well then," she said, laughter replacing the nervousness in her eyes, "maybe you ought to stop monkeying with the damn motor. I mean, it's not as if either of us were virgins." "How did it go?" Mrs. Sales asked the next morning as she set out dishes of homemade confitures on the kitchen table. Martin, irritated, demanded, "How did what go?" "It," Mrs. Sales insisted. "Heavens to Betsy, the carnal knowledge part. I may be pushing 80 from the far side, but I'm sure as hell not brain dead."
"It went very nicely, thank you," Stella said evenly.
"Loosen up, young fellow," Mrs. Sales advised when she noticed Martin buttering a piece of toast for the second time. "You'll be a better bed partner for it." Hoping to change the subject, Martin produced the picture postcard.
"My great-great-grandfather, name of Dave Sanford, built the first sawmill on the banks of the Genesee River," Mrs. Sales explained, all the while rummaging through a knitted tote bag for her reading glasses. "That was long about 1809. This house was built in 1829 with lumber from that mill. Belfast was a one-horse town in those days. Nothing but forests as far as the eye could see, so they say, so they say. When the lumber boom wore out the forests, most folks turned to raising cattle. The White Creek Cheese Factory, which is famous round here, was founded long about 1872 by my great-grandfather."
Stella tried to steer the conversation back to the Amish.
"What about the picture on the postcard?"
"It's going to stay a blur until I come up with my reading spectacles, dear child. Could have sworn I put them in here. Never could figure out how a body can find her reading spectacles if she's not wearing them. Well, I'll be here they are all the while."
Mrs. Sales fitted them on and, accepting the postcard from Stella, held it up to the sunlight streaming through a bay window.
"Like I was saying, I know the Amish crowd up on White Creek Road pretty good because of my family's connection with the White Creek Cheese Factory."
"Hmm." Mrs. Sales pursed her lips.
"Fact is, I don't reckon I recognize any of the Amish on this here picture postcard."
"How about the houses in the barn?" Martin said, coming up behind her, pointing to the two clapboard houses built very close to each other, to the barn with a mansard roof on a rise across from them.
"Houses, barn, neither. Mind you, there are an abundance of Amish living on the small road sloping off White Creek. Picture could have been taken on any one of them."
Mrs. Sales had an inspiration.
"There's a fella named Elkanah Macy, works as a janitor over at the Valley View Amish School on Ramsey Road. He moonlights as a handyman for the Amish out in the White Creek area. If anybody can help you, he can. Be sure to tell Elkanah it was me sent you around."
Elkanah Macy turned out to be a retired Navy petty officer who, judging from the framed photographs lining one wall, had served on half the warships in the U.S. Navy during his 20 years in the service. He had converted the atelier in the Amish school basement into a replica of a ship's machine shop, replete with calendar pinups of naked females.
"Lydia sent you around, you say?"
Macy remarked, sucking on a soggy hand-rolled cigarette as he sized up his visitors through hooded eyes.
"Bet she went and told you the goddamn whopper about Dave Sanford being her great-great-great-granddaddy. Hell, she tells that to anyone stand still long enough to hear her out.
Listen to her tell it anybody who did anything in Belfast was her kin. Sanford's sawmill on the Genesee, the old cheese factory out on White Creek Road. Bet she went and told you about the goddamn ghosts in the attic. Huh! Take it from somebody that knows. Lady's got herself a sprightly imagination. Fact is, the first sales in Allegheny County were loan sharks that went and bought up farmhouses cheap during the 40s and sold them for a handsome profit to the GIs coming back from the war. What is it you want with the Amish over at White Creek?
Martin showed Mr. Macy the picture postcard. You wouldn't by any chance know where we could find these houses, would you?
Might not, depends.
On what? Stella asked.
On how much you'd be willing to pay for the information.
You don't beat around the bush, Stella observed.
Heck, not beating around the damn bush saves time and shoe leather.
Martin peeled off a 50 from a wad of bills. What would half a 100 buy us? Macy snatched the bill out of Martin's fingers.
The two farmhouses with the barn directly across from them are about 3.5 miles out on MacGuffin Ridge Road. Head out of Belfast on South Main and you'll wind up on 19. Look for the Virgin Mary billboard with a 1-800 number. Right after, you'll cross 305 going west. About half a mile further on, you'll hit White Creek Road going south toward Friendship. For some of the way, White Creek Road runs parallel to the factual creek. Along about halfway to Friendship, MacGuffin Ridge Road runs off of White Creek. You gotta be stone blind to miss it.
Martin held up another $50 bill. We're actually looking for an old pal of mine who we think moved into one of the farmhouses in that area.
Your old pal Amish?
No. Not complicated. Macy snatched the second bill.
All them Amish get me over to unplug the damn electric meters and fuse boxes when they move in. Amish don't take to electricity or the things that work off it. Ice boxes, TVs, singers, irons, you name it. You can tell an Amish lives in the house if the electric counter is hanging off the side of it, unplugged. You can tell someone who ain't Amish lives there if the goddamn counter's still attached.
Are there a lot of non-Amish living out on MacGuffin Ridge Road? Asked Martin. When the janitor scratched at his unshaven chin in puzzlement, Martin came up with still another $50 bill.
Amazing how a picture of U.S. Grant can stir up recollections, Macy said, folding the 50 and adding it to the other two in his shirt pocket. Except for one house, MacGuffin Road is all Amish. The one house is the second one on your picture postcard.
Stella turned to Martin, which explains why Samat sent this particular postcard to his mother.
It does, Martin agreed. He nodded at Macy.
That's quite a fleet, he remarked, glancing at the framed photographs on the wall. You served on all those warships?
Never been to actual sea in my life, Macy said with a giggle. Only served on them while they was in dry dock, reason being I get seasick the minute a ship puts to sea.
You certainly picked the wrong service, Stella said. Macy shook his head emphatically.
Loved the goddamn Navy, he said. Loved the ships. Didn't much like what they was floating on, which was the sea. Hell, I'd re-up if they'd take me. Yes, I would.
End of Disc 9. Please continue with the next disc.